You're listening to the Ruby on Rails podcast.
Happy Wednesday and welcome to the show. I'm your host, Elise Schaefer, and I use she, her pronouns. Rails 7 and Hotwire have completely revolutionized server-side Rails apps. Developers can now get much more reactivity with way less JavaScript, less tooling, and simpler deployments. You've probably heard a lot about Rails 7.1 and Hotwire. Maybe you're even using it in production. Today's guest is Ayush Nawatia, who uses he, him pronouns. Ayush is a freelance Ruby and Rails developer living in London. He's been working with Ruby on Rails since 2020, and before that, he specialized in iOS and Android development. He's the author of The Rails and Hotwire Codex and is also on the core team of Bridgetown. He's the co-host of Just a Spec podcast. Outside work, he goes to far too many concerts and likes to follow the England cricket team around the world. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm just going to let the listener know I'm getting over a cold, so I probably sound kind of stuffy. I apologize for that, but that just is where I'm at in life right now. So I'm so happy to have you on the show because I've been meaning to have an episode about Hotwire and Rails. And also, I would love to gush about Bridgetown because I use Bridgetown for my site and I love it too.
I'm glad to hear that.
So why don't we start with like how you got into Rails? You started as an iOS and Android developer and then you moved into Rails in 2020. What was that like?
So I'm from India originally, so I moved to the UK for my undergrad, which was in computer science, and managed to get a job straight out of university. And I just somehow like ended up in like a iOS and Android kind of role in that company. At the time, I was pretty interested in mobile development, and it just kind of fell that way based on the company's needs and stuff like that. So I did that for 5 years, but I was getting progressively more frustrated with the walled garden of mobile apps. So it's just the frustration that I couldn't make something unbelievably silly and just have it on the App Store because Apple won't let me because they'll say it's too silly. And also I kind of get my motivation from building products, not so much of the technical side of things, but I like building like products. And when my skill set was just app development and nothing on the server, it's quite hard to kind of build a product that's just an app. There's not a lot of scope there without any kind of server-side component. So between those two things, I was getting a bit frustrated. And there's quite a lot of Ruby in like the iOS ecosystem. Not so much anymore, but back when I used to do it, there was the most popular dependency manager was called CocoaPods, which was written in Ruby. There was this CI kind of tool called Fastlane, which was all Ruby. So I had done a bit of Ruby just as a byproduct of doing iOS development. And I was aware of the existence of Rails. I'd bought the Rails tutorial at some point and never got around to doing anything with it. But it seemed like the natural progression that I wanted to build web apps because I wanted to build products, and I was familiar with Ruby at a basic level. I knew of a thing called Rails. I had the Rails tutorial as might as well, right? So when I eventually could quit my job in 2019 without getting kicked out of the country because I finally got residency after my visa, I was like, okay, well, best chance possible to make the switch. So I did. And I spent 2020 just working through the Rails tutorial and building stuff and ended up freelancing.
Nice. That's awesome. I'm curious, as someone who has dabbled a little bit in Swift, I'm curious what you think of Ruby as compared to Swift.
So actually, I started iOS development with Objective-C and then moved to Swift as it became a bit more popular. I think around 2017 time, I changed jobs and that was all Swift after that. But because my grounding was in Objective-C, it's got a very similar ethos to Ruby in terms of metaprogramming and sharp knives and things like that. All the mad stuff that you can do with Ruby, you can do with Objective-C. And some of the code bases I worked with had a lot of that metaprogramming stuff, so it was something I was already familiar with. And when I moved to Ruby, it seemed like it was a nicer way to do all those things. Ruby just provided a nicer syntax and nicer constructs to do all the things that Objective-C let you do. But when I moved to Swift, I did get a bit frustrated with it because in my mind, the Swift team were constantly changing stuff, chasing academic perfection, quote unquote, whatever that means, rather than trying to make a good user-friendly language. That was another reason why I wanted to switch, really, is what I perceived to be the Javafication of Swift to some extent was kind of taking away a lot of the power that Objective-C gave you. It did have a nicer syntax for sure. It was way more expressive, but I didn't like how a lot of the advanced stuff was being taken out of the hands of the programmer.
I haven't done a lot with Objective-C, but the one thing that I know about it is that it's got a very similar way of thinking about object orientation, right? As like message passing. Like I think in Objective-C, they specifically call it like a message.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like the syntax to like send a message or call a method, whichever version of the phrase you use,
yeah,
is completely different to any other programming language.
Yeah. Yes, it is. That's like the most difficult part of Objective-C.
It is. And I remember going on the Wikipedia page for Ruby when I was first contemplating switching to web and thinking about what I would do. And it said that Ruby is a message passing language. And I was like, ha, I know what that means.
So I am curious. I do want to talk about Bridgetown for a little bit. What's it like being on the core team of Bridgetown?
For me personally, it's something that I kind of dip in and out of. Jared White, who started the project, is still the primary contributor. My role in the last year or so has been more around like just strategy and bouncing ideas off me and just keeping an eye on development, suggesting ideas and stuff. Because I've been quite busy first writing my book and then just with freelancing in the last year or so. So I haven't had a whole lot of time to dedicate to the project. Although in the last few weeks, I've finally got my hands dirty with some more Bridgetown codes. I'm really happy with that. So I'll have stuff in the next release. Yeah, for me, it's been more of a when time allows, get involved with it kind of thing. And I keep an eye on what's going on with development. I always make sure if I see something that I feel is not quite going in the right direction, I'll always write a post and then usually Jared and I'll figure out a way forward from that. So yeah, in the last year, it's not been very active, but I've definitely been passively involved. I've been trying quite hard to get a Bridgetown talk in a conference, but I just haven't had any luck with that yet. So I'd quite like to help with kind of growing the framework a bit. I just haven't had any luck on that side yet.
Yeah, I switched to Bridgetown from Jekyll, I don't even remember when, a few years ago, I think. At the time, I was like not using a lot of Bridgetown features. I just like essentially spun up a Bridgetown site, put a style sheet up, and then just copied all my Markdown files in the source thing. But I recently did a redesign of my website. And when I did, I started using like Bridgetown components. And like, it's a really nice framework for building static sites. I think it also just kind of fits. I think it just fits my brain a little bit, similar to Ruby and Rails. So yeah, I just wanted to gush about it for a minute.
Yeah, I'm really, really happy to hear that, because that's what we aim with the framework, is we want to kind of modernize the thing that Jekyll kind of established. We want to just modernize it. And
yeah,
we've added like new features on top, like server-side rendering and stuff like that. But one of the core principles that I'm very passionate about with the project is I want the simple stuff always to be simple. So like if someone doesn't care about having dynamic endpoints or Bridgetown components or anything like that, all the simple stuff should still be simple and they can just ignore those advanced features. So I really want that kind of direction for Bridgetown, that those features are always there for you to use, but they're never forced onto you.
Yeah, it's a very progressive framework where you can adopt things as you need them. I am curious. I want to talk about your book. So you have a book called The Rails and Hotwire Codex. Can you talk about what led you to writing this book?
In 2020, when I was learning Rails, I worked through the Ruby on Rails tutorial by Michael Hartl, which I think is a rite of passage for pretty much every Rails developer. I built an app called Chapter 24, which is like a blogging app, which looking back, honestly, the code is shambolic. So I'm looking to decommission it, but it gave me something to show for my work. And while building that, and as I got started with freelancing, I realized that the Rails tutorial gives you a fantastic base, but that's it. It was just a base. There was no next step that was very obvious to me. It was like, I've understood the basics, but where do I go to kind of level up from here? And I just had a random idea. And I think while I was on my first contract a few months in, that I've got a pretty unique career trajectory where I specialized in iOS, Android, and web at different parts of my career. I was always aware of Turbo Lynx Native before Turbo came out and Turbo Native and stuff. I never got to use it on an actual project because hybrid is almost like a forbidden term amongst native app developers. So I did suggest it once and got immediately shut down. So I was aware of it. So I thought, well, maybe I can use my slightly unique skill set to write a book that teaches you how to build a web app, iOS app, and Android app all at the same time. Because there's plenty of books that teach you how to make web apps and native apps. There's nothing that teaches you all three. So I kind of let the idea marinate in my head for a few months. And what I came up with was maybe I can build a next step after the Rails tutorial. This is where people can go next to learn more about the framework. So yeah, that was kind of my idea for it. And I think because I was fairly new to Rails when I started this, I think I'd only had about a year's professional experience and maybe about just under 2 years of actually using it. But I had about 7 years of programming experience behind me. That, again, was a bit unique where I was an experienced programmer, but new to Rails. So I didn't have a lot of the curse of knowledge that people with 7 or 8 years of Rails experience would have. I was still approaching it a bit like a newbie, but with the experience behind me. So again, I think that really helped with writing, because when I look back at, like, I do use my own book as reference quite a lot. And when I look back and read some of the stuff, I'm like, by now, I've internalized all those things. If I had to go back and write this now, I wouldn't be able to, because I've just internalized a lot of the stuff. So that was another thing that kind of motivated me to write the book.
I want to touch on something you said about building an app and then thinking you're going to decommission it. I feel like that's a very common thing. The number of apps that I've worked on or side projects that I've built where I just like get to them a year later and I'm like, actually, this is terrible. I'm just going to close this down. It's interesting. I am very excited about the idea that as a Rails developer, I could branch out into mobile and carry some of what I know into building a mobile app. I think that for a while, you would have to either have all of the Android and all of the iOS stuff on separate teams and powered by an API, or you would use something like Flutter or React Native or something powered by an API. But the idea that you could just render your Rails views and then be able to leverage that in the mobile app is very exciting. And that's one of the things that was most exciting to me about Hotwire, this idea that you could take the work that you've done on a Rails app and put it into a new space. So I'm just curious, as someone who's coming from the iOS, from the mobile realm, what are your thoughts on that and like how it maybe compares to the way of having an API that's backing a native mobile app?
I think it's a really clever approach because you're still using a native backbone in your app. So like, let's say you have a tab bar and stuff like that. Those will always still be native. When on iOS, for example, when you kind of go through screens, you get that animation where the screen slides in from the right. You just get all that for free because the backbone of the app is still native. It's a completely different approach to things like PhoneGap, where everything is web. Flutter, which I think literally draws views from scratch. So it kind of doesn't use any of the view libraries that iOS and Android give you, and it draws everything from scratch. React Native is a bit of a weird one because I still don't completely understand how it works. It's like, it does render fully native views, but it uses JavaScript to do so. And I haven't used it myself because I've avoided it like the plague, but I have spoken to friends who have used it. And they just say the developer ergonomics are just horrible. So coming back to the original point of Turbo and how Turbo Native works, it doesn't try to fight the native platform. It kind of says that we will still use Xcode, we will still use Swift and Android Studio and Kotlin and all that stuff. But instead of writing native code to render the content of each screen, we'll just render HTML in a web view for just the content. So you have the navigation and all that stuff still as native. So you get the platform for this familiar platform specific conventions and UI and stuff like that. This gets you maybe about 80 or 90% of the fidelity that you would get with a fully native app. For most apps, that's probably good enough. The other good thing is there's like an escape hatch. So like if you look at the Hey email app, for example, the inbox, as they call it, is fully native because that's the screen that the users are going to spend most of the time on. So they built it fully natively. But other screens like settings and things like that, those are just web views. So it gives you the sliding scale where you're kind of not all in on either approach. You can pick and choose. I think that's really powerful because like I remember in my previous job as a native iOS developer, I had to build an FAQ page in the app. And because I wasn't allowed to use Turbo Links or anything like that, I just had to copy the approach. And I just had a web view that was rendering the FAQ page in HTML. And then I ran some custom JavaScript to hide certain elements on that page, like a navbar and things like that, that weren't needed. And in one afternoon, I built this and I went and showed it to the product manager. And he was like, you did that in an afternoon? Like, seriously? Because I couldn't tell the difference between a native screen and a web screen. That looks perfectly fine to me. So we released that. And then I got some heat from the FAQ team saying, why did you just use the web view? Like, you're not supposed to do that. You're a native developer. We're going to give you an API. You're supposed to call that API and render everything natively. And I'm like, so you're going to spend I don't know how many weeks building that API. Then I'm going to spend I don't know how many weeks building that natively when I just did it in an afternoon. It was like, I don't understand the logic there. When, yeah, like I said, I showed it to a non-technical person and they couldn't tell the difference.
This reminds me of something that I've had this conversation a couple of times around planning versus building. I sort of have gotten to a point in my career where I feel like if you ask me to spend 2 weeks planning a project versus spending 2 weeks building it like a couple different ways, like I think the building it a couple different ways is more valuable. And I think that the nice thing about Hotwire and the nice thing about being able to like just reuse the server view that you're using and be able to put it everywhere is that it makes it so much easier to do the prototyping phase and build a several different prototypes because you can just reuse the views. And that is like a huge developer productivity win, I think.
Yeah, I completely agree. I don't really understand the concept of spending so long in planning. If you've worked in a Scrum environment, and I'm sure many of our listeners have, the planning poker and those planning meetings, and I've sat in those just losing the will to live. I'm always in favor of actually doing stuff rather than planning.
I don't want to turn this into an agile podcast, but yeah, I think you just learn more from doing. You learn way more. You never know less than you do at the start of a project. And there's really no substitute for feeling out the ergonomics of whatever you're building. If I build something three different ways, I know which way I preferred at the end of that.
Yep, absolutely.
So what are some common Rails mistakes that you've seen as part of your contract work and maybe some mistakes that maybe make Hotwire more difficult?
The biggest mistake, it's a bit of a broad one that I kind of see in like quite a few code bases that I've worked on as a freelancer, is people deviating from the Rails way. And I know that's different people have different interpretations of that, but what I mean by it is introducing different kinds of patterns that Rails doesn't necessarily encourage, things like service objects or a presenter pattern, or I've seen one code base like a concept of widgets, and none of these were like thoroughly formed or thought through. They were like, to my eye, it was like someone didn't quite understand how to structure their code, read a blog post by someone who was quite smart and used a certain pattern knowingly in a certain way. and then just applied that without a whole lot of thought to whether it fits in with their specific problem. I don't blame developers for this. I just think there is a bit of a lack of education in how to use certain Rails patterns that I hope the modernization of the Rails guides and the documentation and stuff will look to address. So like, I'm a big fan of things like concerns, which is just the mix-in pattern of object-oriented programming. I don't think it's very well understood by a lot of people. For me personally, I got it quite quickly just because I came from a Swift background where this thing called protocol-oriented programming was something that Apple was pushing quite heavily, which is the same concept as concerns, really. It's just you define behavior and then you mix it into classes and stuff. So I kind of got it quite quickly just because of that. But I think people do struggle to understand some of that kind of stuff. Then I've seen people not quite understand just the problem of domain modeling. So you kind of get a Rails developer who may or may not be very proficient in databases, and they lay the foundation of the app and the schema is not very well thought through. And that's a very difficult thing to do, is lay the foundation of a new app. And your database schema is almost the most important thing. It's more important than even the code, because code can be fixed. But once your database schema is less than optimal, you're kind of stuck with that and it's really hard to fix. I can't remember who said in a RailsConf talk that if you lost your database, you're completely stuffed. If you lost your code, you can recover from that. If suddenly your code just disappeared and you still have your database, it's possible to recover from that. But if your database disappears, you can't recover from that. So I don't think just database design necessarily gets the respect it deserves in Rails apps. And I'm generalizing here. Database views and things like that are like underused techniques in my experience. So yeah, those are like some of the big things that I kind of see the mistakes being made over and over again. And I just hope that with some education, we can try and prevent people from going down these paths a little bit. In terms of like Hotwire specifically, I think it's too new a thing. I haven't seen people use it in any horribly wrong way or anything like that. It's usually just the transition pains that you would get from a legacy code base moving to Turbo. There's nothing inherently wrong that I've seen.
I think for me, Hotwire, especially the Hotwire Rails gem, is really kind of making some assumptions that you're building your Rails app in the Rails way, right? So
yeah.
I'm just curious if someone didn't build it in the Rails way, like if they did have a bunch of service objects, or if they did have complicated domain model, if that would make rendering the partial for a model and sending it over the WebSocket, if that would be like more difficult if you're not kind of structuring your app in that way.
Yeah, it is. So I just finished a contract that ran for over a year where I was rewriting an app's front end using Vue components and Tailwind and Turbo. And it was incredibly challenging because there were too many different kinds of patterns being used in the app, and the domain model was a very complicated domain model in the first place. And then, in my opinion, it was less than optimal as well. So it was very challenging to kind of work on it in the Rails way. And that's, I think, a common problem, because the more people kind of deviate from it, the Rails team kind of assumes when they apply updates to the framework or anything like that, they kind of assume that people are using Rails in the Rails way. And I think that's the right thing to do. So when you deviate from that, I think you really need to know what you're doing and have a good reason for doing it. I don't think people always do, which is when you come to upgrading Rails or a new feature that Rails introduces and you're like, yeah, I don't know how to introduce that into my code base because I've done all this custom stuff.
I think a good example of that is prior to action text. Action text was solving a problem that people had solved a variety of other ways. But then action text exists and it's like, well, I can't convert what I've been doing to action text without thinking through all of this stuff as an idea of like some of that. Or active storage is maybe a better example where people were using like paperclip or something and then it gets built into the framework.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, sometimes it's almost like not worth transitioning to something just because Rails gives it to you. I mean, if I have worked on some old code bases which were using things like, I think, Carrier Wave and stuff like that, and there just wasn't a good reason to switch to active storage. Like what we had worked, and well, might as well, right? Going forward, if you wanted to like integrate active storage or something, then it does become quite challenging if you're an older code base that's already done something.
So looking ahead, we are presumably going to get Rails 8 later this year at Rails World. What are you excited about with Rails 8 and the future of Rails?
For me personally, I'm quite looking forward to something that's actually already out but will be integrated into Rails 8, which is Solid Queue, because I'm a huge fan of Sidekick. I use it on all my projects, but it'll be nice to have something that's kind of baked into Rails itself and that's reliant on the database rather than Redis. So that kind of makes Redis more of an optional dependency where I only need it if I'm using Action Cable, because you need the pub sub thing for that. So it just makes it one more moving part that I can remove from my stack if need be. And it's nice that Rails will have a default that it gives you out of the box for something that's as critical as queuing, because I think pretty much every app needs it. And when I was first starting out, I remember just not being able to get my head around what exactly jobs and queuing were, because Rails gives you active job, but that's just an interface, right? It took me longer than I'd care to admit to realize that, oh wait, I need another thing. Active job by itself is not enough. I need to plug in something else to actually do the work. So yeah, I think that's another barrier to newbies is that you need to go research a third party backend that you plug into active job, and it'll be nice that Rails has a solution that's kind of baked into it.
I'm excited for a couple of things. I think it's going to be great that there's going to be an authentication generator. I guess most people are using Devise, but when I'm building like my own thing on the side, I almost never use Devise.
I'm not a fan of Devise personally yet, and I use it for commercial projects again just because it's the most battle-tested option. But yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah, I wrote one user model and I always just copy that user model in the migration into whatever new app I'm building. And so it'll be nice to just have a generator that does something probably similar to what I'm doing for most of my personal stuff. And then there was something else that I was excited about.
Was it like Solid Cache or Thruster Action Notifier?
Action Notifier is the other one, yeah. Because that is like a thing that also like almost every app needs is some kind of notification thing. And and just like the number of things that you can get with Rails out of the box is kind of exciting. And I think it's going to be a huge benefit for developers and especially for people starting new projects. I think it's going to be big, which I think will be good for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm quite looking forward to Action Notifier as well, because actually one of the things I had on my wish list of topics for my book was push notifications. But it was starting to get far too much into native app territory. I only wanted to kind of skirt the native world because it's still a book on web development. So I decided to drop it at the end because it just couldn't find a way for it to fit. But with Action Notifier, which will use like the web platform for push notifications, and I think it might have adapters for native as well, it just becomes a lot more approachable.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show. I've started asking this final question of all of my guests really selfishly so that I can just create a wish list of things that people want to hear about. But what is a topic that you think we should cover on the show or that you would like to hear about on the show?
So this might be a bit of a recency bias, but I've kind of been a bit knee deep in trying to understand Rack 3 and concurrency and stuff like that. Because Rack 3 introduced the concept of persistent connections. So you could like have WebSockets installed literally in your Rails controller in theory.
So, oh. That is interesting.
Yeah, it'd be great to kind of have something about using the Falcon web server with Rails, and because that's like highly concurrent, uses Ruby fibers rather than Puma threads and things like that, and how like Rails can make the most of like Rack 3 features. That would be something quite cool, I think.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm happy that I'm asking this now because I'm coming up with so many good things to talk about. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's been great chatting with you.
This has been the Ruby on Rails podcast. It was a pleasure talking with Ayush. You can find his consultancy at radioactivetoy.tech. You can learn more about Rails and Hotwire Codecs at railsandhotwirecodecs.com. You can follow Ayush on ruby.social at ruby.social/@Ayush. And you can listen to the Just a Spec podcast at justaspec.show. Links for all of that will be in the show notes. Have a question about building Rails apps with Hotwire? Send an email to comments@therubyonrailspodcast.com. You can include a text comment or attach a file from Voice Memos or Google Recorder, and we'll respond to some of them in a future show. Thanks to Paul, our wonderful editor over at Peachtree Sound, for making us sound like professionals. And thank you for listening. You're a gem.
You've been listening to the Ruby on Rails podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded to stay in the loop on Ruby on Rails and open source software. While you're at it, please leave us a review. And thank you for listening.